From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our first guest this morning, Dr. David Inouye, first came to the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, known as RAMBL, in 1971, and he started his PhD research there the next year. He was a graduate student studying hummingbirds and bumblebees, and he wanted to know what flower nectar resources are available for them. So he started counting flowers, as he says, and he kept counting year after year. Now, after 49 years, the data set that he and fellow researchers have amassed is one of the longest and most comprehensive on record. Dr. Inouye's studies have also shed great light on the effects of climate change. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Maryland, and we are so happy he can join us by phone. Dr. David Inouye, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. It's great to have you. I'm so interested in what first attracted you to, it's over 9,000 feet, the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, high up in the mountains above Crested Butte, Colorado. Why did you first go there?
A couple of my college faculty members had worked out there at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab. In fact, one of them had been a director of that facility. And when I was looking for an opportunity to take some field ecology classes the summer before I started graduate school, that became an obvious choice.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful, beautiful place. I was lucky enough to be there back in September. And the research that goes on at that site is beyond what anyone could really imagine. Now you've been going there for nearly 50 years every summer. And it really, as I said in the intro, it provides this long glimpse at the effects of everything from climate change to, namely climate change. And we see those effects at higher altitudes more readily. Can you explain that?
As the climate's changing, it's not changing uniformly. And some of the strongest effects of the current climate change are happening at higher latitudes and now at higher altitudes. It took a while for us to start picking out a signal of climate change up at 9,500 feet, in part because the climate there is so variable, naturally variable. We can have as much as a six-week difference from one year to the next in terms of when the snow melts, and therefore when flowers come into bloom. So in order to discern a significant trend, given that kind of variation, you really have to have decades of data.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. David Inouye, who is a research ecologist at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory near Crested Butte, Colorado. Dr. Inouye, I did not know the indirect ramifications of some of the things that you talked about in our new climate. And one of the things that fascinated me was that although things are warming up, the last frost, I believe you said in one of your papers, continues to be on or around June 10th. And yet, if you have a snow melt that starts early because, it gets a little warmer in, let's say, March and April, then the biology can flower and can start making leaves and all this sort of thing. And then when the hard frost comes in, that can cause damage, can't it?
That's right. So back when snow used to melt up there towards the end of May or even the beginning of June, there wasn't much time for plants to develop by the time that the last frost hit. But now, particularly on south-facing slopes, it's not uncommon to see flowering starting as early as the middle of April. And that's in a year like that, if flowering does begin that early, then by the first week in June or the 10th of June, if we still get a frost, there are many species of plants that have put up their leaves and some have put up buds. And some of those wildflowers are sensitive to frost. And that kind of effect of climate change is something that we're actually seeing at lower altitudes not just here in Colorado, but around the U.S. and around the world. It's not uncommon now for us to have what's being called a false spring sometime in March here in the North Fork Valley of in Colorado, which is an important fruit growing region. And then if we get a warm spell in March, that'll trigger the apricots trees, which are the earliest fruit trees to bloom, to start flowering. And then we could still have a frost in April. And last year, for instance, that happened, and there were no apricots, no cherries, no peaches, no apples. This year, we escaped that that false spring and subsequent frost and had a fantastic fruit crop. But that kind of effect of climate change is affecting agriculture around the world, and not just the wildflowers.
Well, this is fascinating. So the indirect consequence of an earlier snow melt and the hard frost, the last frost of the season, still coming in around June 10th, you've explained that for the plant life. But there are other indirect consequences now for the bees that show up on the scene, or the hummingbirds, or the animals that are spreading seeds and those sorts of things. Can you talk about how some of those indirect consequences contribute to problems?
Sure. One example that I'll start with comes from a collaboration with Dr. Carol Boggs, who's a researcher at RMBL, but is a faculty member at University of South Carolina. And she had a 9-year data set for a butterfly population, a fritill area that she'd studied. So she had 9 years of data, which she hadn't published because she couldn't figure out why it was so variable. Why were there big populations of butterflies 1 year and much smaller ones the next year? And she happened to mention to me at one point that this butterfly is a little bit unusual, and that the females, the number of eggs that a female can make and lay depends on how much nectar it collects as an adult, instead of using just the resources that were garnered as a caterpillar. And those butterflies get about 90% or more of their nectar from just one wildflower, a daisy. And I said, oh, well, I have a long-term data set for that daisy, and why don't we put our data sets together, which we did, and we're able to find that over 85% of the variation in the butterfly population from 1 year to the next could be explained by that ratio of butterflies to flowers the year before. So if there are lots of flowers, the females get lots of nectar, they lay lots of eggs, and the next year is a big year for the butterflies. But that wildflower is one of the ones that's sensitive to frost. And so if you have a frost and the buds get killed, there's not much opportunity for those butterflies to find nectar, and then the butterfly population declines. And it's pretty unusual for an insect population to be able to explain almost all of the variation of what's making a good year or a bad year for those, for that insect. And so this was a pretty unusual study, and was only facilitated by the fact that we both had long-term data sets from the same field site.
That's pretty incredible that you made those connections. Wondering how it evolves that a butterfly or a hummingbird might migrate sooner. I mean, if you're talking about the first flower, the buds coming out in April, say, instead of what it used to be, late May, early June, how does that influence their patterns of behavior, whether it's the butterfly or the broadtail hummingbird?
Yeah, well, almost all the insects are resident there year-round. So the butterflies are being exposed to the same climate that the wildflowers are. That's also true of bumblebees that I've worked with. So the bumblebee queens are spending their winter underground. And if you have snow melt earlier, then the soil warms up earlier and the bumblebee queens will come out earlier. The migratory species, like the hummingbirds or some moths that are migratory, are influenced by the changing climate back where they're spending the winter. So these hummingbirds, for instance, the broad-tailed hummingbirds that reproduce up at Gothic during the summer, are spending the winter down probably in the mountains in Mexico, and they're getting some cue down there, probably in part day length, telling them that it's time to start working our way up the migratory corridor towards the mountain breeding grounds. But they have to pay attention to what floral resources are available along the way. And so if we have an early season in Colorado, it's probably also likely going to be an early season in Arizona or New Mexico and other areas where those hummingbirds are going to be passing through. Sometimes they do arrive a little bit too early, and they'll come up and look around for flowers, look around for feeders, and then have to go back down to lower altitudes where there are feeders and there are flowers. But the timing of the migration and the timing of flowering do seem to be changing at different rates. So we're seeing flowering happening earlier than the arrival dates of the hummingbirds. And if that trend continues, then the hummingbirds might be arriving up at their summer breeding grounds after some of the flowers they're used to visiting have already finished.
Wow. So I don't know this, that the life cycle of a flower, at what point is the optimum amount of nectar present? Is it right after it buds, or is it somewhere else in the life cycle?
Nectar production in flowers is an interesting process, and we have some flowers up in Gothic that only last for one day. For instance, the blue flax flowers, each flower only lasts one day, and then there'll be other flowers that may last for a week or more. And so the nectar secretion pattern varies from flower to flower, but pretty commonly you'd find that soon after they open for the first time, there'd be a pretty good amount of nectar and also the availability of pollen to attract those pollinators.
Dr. Inouye, you're a professor emeritus at the University of Maryland. Is that College Park?
That's right.
Yeah.
So I used to have to make a 2,000-mile migration each spring out to Colorado to my study site and then reverse that trip back at the end of August to go back to teach. But now that I'm retired from teaching, I'm living out here year-round in Colorado and have very easy access to my field site. In fact, I'm going to head up there this weekend for one more trip.
Oh, that's great. I'm not sure how this happened. I went to University of Maryland, College Park, and I was working really hard to get as many courses in as I could. I majored in economics and finance, but as I got to my senior year, I found out I had all these electives that I could have used. And one of the smartest moves I ever made, you know, people might make fun of this, but I took beekeeping. And University of Maryland is a land-grant college with beautiful, beautiful grounds and horses and cows and bees. And it began my love affair with bees. It was the coolest course I've ever taken.
Oh, nice. I know that apiary, so I probably know where you spent some time. And I think I probably know the faculty member you took that course with. In fact, there are a couple of pollination biologists now in the entomology department there who are doing some pretty exciting work with honeybees and other pollinators.
Yeah, and you had mentioned earlier when you were speaking with Lynn that bumblebees that go underground in the wintertime, are there any bee species that actually migrate that will travel a distance in the off-season?
No, bees, let's see, at least here in North America, we don't have any migratory bee species. They're resident. We do have a great diversity of bees. For instance, in Colorado, there are almost 1,000 different native bee species. And up at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab, we now have 11 years of data on the bee populations there. A collaborator from North Carolina State University, Dr. Becky Irwin, has for 11 years now been trapping bees every other week in the same meadows where we're monitoring flower abundance. And so we're beginning to get a handle on how variation in the flowers is affecting these 150 different bee species. So that's also a pretty remarkable data set that we're putting together there.
Yeah, and what is the latest on what is the largest contributor to declining bee populations? Because we've heard about chemicals, we've heard about so many different things. What is really going on in your view?
It's not an easy answer to that, but I think a couple of the things that you've pointed to are very important factors, one of which is pesticides, and including this category of pesticides called neonicotinoids, which are relatively new. They've been around, maybe 15 years. And actually, it was about the time that they were introduced that we started to see some problems with significant bee kills from pesticide use. We now know that those neonicotinoids can affect the development of bees. They can affect their foraging behavior. They affect their longevity. But habitat alteration, so the fact that many of the solitary bees in North America are ground nesting bees, and if the ground is disturbed regularly or converted from natural habitat to farmlands, they lose their habitats. In terms of the honeybees, there's also been a problem with introduced diseases, and almost all the commercial honeybees in North America get moved to California in the spring to pollinate almonds. And that means that they all come into contact with each other and all share diseases. And so pretty quickly, some of these newly introduced viruses or parasites can spread into the honeybees that are then transported back all around the country. And so those are maybe some of the three major reasons why not just honeybees, but some of the native bumblebees and other native species are also having problems. Those habitat alteration or habitat loss, introduced diseases, and pesticides.
It's an unfortunate story, isn't it?
Yes.
On the brighter side, if there is a brighter side, wildflowers are prevalent in, well, in fact, the Crested Butte area, the mountains around there, it's like the capital of wildflowers in the entire West, if not the country. And I didn't realize to what degree it was, that it is a major tourist destination in prime wildflower season. That says a lot. What is going on right? What is the positive side that keeps wildflowers going, and how do they adapt to the changing climate?
Yes, Colorado was, or Crested Butte was designated as the wildflower capital of Colorado, and there is an annual wildflower festival that runs for a whole week, and it is pretty spectacular. There are other parts of the Rockies that also have great wildflowers, but Crested Butte has a spectacular display. I guess one of the reasons it's done well is the fact that there is a lot of protected area around. There are a lot of national forest land, for instance, and those wildflower meadows have been protected. There's also a diversity of climates, so very quickly you can move from the altitude of Crested Butte up at 8,800 feet and all the way up to over 13,000 feet, and that geographic diversity or elevational diversity creates a lot of diversity of wildflowers. And we've been fortunate that in terms of the climate that we're still getting, for instance, lots of precipitation, and a good year for snowpack and rain makes for a very good year for wildflowers. And so as long as we're able to continue to get a pretty good snowpack, we'll probably continue to have pretty good wildflowers.
Well, it's a beautiful place. You're a lucky man to live where you do. And lots of stories about your work you can find at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory website, which is rmbl.org. A really interesting article about the monument plant that you've been studying, and we'll let our listeners find it for themselves. But Dr. David Inouye, we thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Really interesting work that you do.
You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.